Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Homicide at the Haunted House by Beth Dolgner. Narrated by Patria Burchard. Chapter 1. I crested the hill and squinted as the late afternoon sun glared through my windshield. Ahead of me, the interstate stretched in a long, straight line for miles before finally disappearing into a cluster of hills, which were slowly darkening to a purple hue on the horizon. Red dots danced in my vision, and I blinked, willing my eyes to adjust. No, I realized, it wasn't the sun affecting me. I was seeing brake lights, a whole sea of them about a mile ahead. Beyond them, blue lights flashed. I couldn't see what had happened up there, but I knew it wasn't good. The three cars in front of me made a last-minute dive onto an exit ramp, and I followed suit. As the interstate continued down the hill and into the valley, I turned left onto a two-lane road that bridged the interstate and wound south through the hills. An army of tall saguaros threw long shadows across the road, and scrubby trees clung desperately to the rocky slopes. Ever since I had crossed the state line into Arizona, the landscape had become increasingly desolate. Everywhere I looked, there was a different kind of cactus waiting to stab me. I sure hoped the drivers ahead of me knew where they were going. Their cars looked shiny and relatively new, which meant they probably had GPS. My car was so old it only had a radio and a CD player, and I hadn't owned any CDs for at least a decade. That meant I had been listening to local radio stations for the past 2 days and 5 states. The last time I knew so many top 40 songs, I was in college, and a full 3 dress sizes slimmer. I didn't even have a cell phone anymore, so I couldn't use the map on that. With that thought, I pressed the gas pedal just a little harder to close the small gap between me and the car ahead. There was no way I was going to risk losing sight of them on this winding road. I needed to be able to find my way back onto the interstate so I could finish up what had to be the most miserable road trip of my life. Just 5 more hours, and I would be at my brother's house in San Diego. Even if I stopped for some cheap gas station coffee, I would still make it there before midnight. There were no crossroads as I continued to follow the other cars south. The road was slowly gaining elevation, but it definitely wasn't curving west at all. We were going farther and farther away from the interstate. I had been driving on the road for at least 20 minutes when I saw another blinking light. This time, it wasn't from brake lights or police cars. It was the yellow check engine light on my dash. "Oh, come on," I moaned. My eyes darted across the dash, and I watched as the needle on the engine temperature gauge slowly moved upward. "No, no, no, please, no. I need to get to San Diego tonight." Here's the thing about talking to your car. It doesn't talk back, and it definitely does not listen. Finally, I saw a stop sign coming up. The cars ahead of me were all turning right, going west again to parallel the interstate. When it was my turn at the intersection, I glanced right and saw nothing but more sharp plants and rocks. I looked straight ahead and saw a plywood sign with faded blue paint that read, "Repairs, oil changes, AC coolant, 3 miles ahead." I jumped at the sound of honking, and I glanced in my rearview mirror to see a line of cars snaking behind me, all waiting for their turn to get back to civilization, too. I looked at my dash, hopefully, but the engine temperature needle was still rotating toward the top of the gauge, creeping closer to the red "Don't you dare keep driving" part. I sighed, switched off my turn signal, and went straight. "Only 3 miles, car," I said coaxingly. "You can do this." It couldn't. I had only gone about 1.5 miles when the dash suddenly lit up like a Christmas tree. The temperature needle was buried in the red. I lost count of the expletives I muttered as I guided the car onto the narrow shoulder and turned it off. I was on a steep incline, so I pulled the parking brake and hoped the car would stay put. Actually, Part of me hoped it would roll off the side of the hill, catch on fire, and explode on contact with the rocky valley below. But then I'd really be stranded. I figured there was no point trying to take any of my belongings with me. The little I had left to call my own would probably be safe out there. I hadn't passed a single car since I had gone straight through that stop sign. I grabbed my purse, locked up the car, and started walking. As I hoofed it up the incline, I noticed there were fewer cacti, but quite a few taller, leafier trees dotting the landscape. It seemed that the higher I climbed into the hills, the less threatening the plants were. It wasn't much of a silver lining, but it was all I had. It was hot out, probably 100 degrees or more, but at least the sun was sinking fast. By the time I finally spotted a whitewashed cinder block garage around a curve in the road, the sun had just sunk beneath the hills on the horizon. The same faded blue paint I had seen on the plywood sign was also on the side of the garage, with "Done Right Auto Repair" written in a flowing script. By the time I walked through the creaking wooden door at the front of the garage, I was sweaty, tired, and fighting the urge to just start yelling. It wasn't that I was mad at anyone. I was just fed up with the whole situation.
"Be right with you,"
the man's voice echoed from a room behind the front office, and soon the body it belonged to appeared in the doorway. He somehow looked like the garage itself. His oil-streaked white overalls seemed too large on his lean frame, and his blue eyes were as faded as the paint on the sign. He smiled, his teeth bright in contrast to his tanned face.
"Good timing. I was just closing up for the weekend. What can I do for you?"
"For the weekend?" I repeated. I brushed a sweaty lock of auburn hair out of my eyes.
"Yeah, I take weekends off so I can spend more time with my daughter."
The man gave me a quick wink.
"Unless, of course, it's an emergency."
I waved vaguely in the direction I had come from. "My car overheated. I had to ditch it on the side of the road." The man nodded grimly.
"That is an emergency. Let's get your car towed up here, then we'll figure out what's next. I'm Nick Dalton."
"Olivia Kendrick. Thanks." Nick pulled a rag with even more oil and dirt on it than his overalls out of a pocket. He wiped his hand on it before reaching out. I tried to keep my grimace to a minimum as I shook his proffered hand, since I had no interest in being covered in oil, too. Nick's grip was warm and firm, and I was surprised to feel my lips start to turn into a genuine smile. There was just something comforting about him. I might be stranded in the middle of nowhere, I thought, but at least I'm stranded with this guy. In just a few minutes, I was sitting uncomfortably in the passenger seat of Nick's tow truck. The springs sagged, and a rip in the faux leather upholstery had been covered up with silver duct tape that squeaked every time I shifted. Nick asked me a steady stream of questions as we drove, like where I was headed, where I had come from, and how I had managed to stray so far from the interstate. When we pulled up next to my car and came to a stop, Nick whistled.
"You came all the way from Nashville in that?"
He sounded both horrified and impressed. "It's all I could afford," I said stiffly, shrugging. Nick looked at me keenly.
"I just didn't think someone carrying such an expensive designer purse would drive a hunk of junk like that."
Ouch. I made a mental note that even though Nick looked like a mess, his mind was sharp. I instinctively clutched my purse closer. When I had sold everything off, I had flat out refused to get rid of my purse. Some things were non-negotiable. It was nearly dark already, and Nick grabbed a big silver flashlight from a box that sat between the driver and passenger seats.
"Let's see what we're dealing with," he said,
before sliding deftly out of the tow truck. I got out a lot less gracefully, scrambling my way down. Nick was already opening the hood of my car, though, so at least he hadn't witnessed my awkward exit. I walked over to him, and my eyes followed the beam of his flashlight, which he trained at my radiator. I crossed my arms and tried to look like I understood what I was seeing. Nick suddenly dropped onto his knees to peer underneath the car. He stood up again, produced that same dirty rag, and pulled the dipstick out of the oil reservoir. I suppressed a sardonic laugh. The last car I'd owned hadn't even had a dipstick for checking oil. The car's computer would simply know if the oil was low, and beam a message to the dash to tell me it needed service.
"I hate to say it, but you've got an oil leak," Nick said.
To his credit, he actually did sound sorry about giving me such bad news.
"I had hoped you just needed to top off your radiator fluid, but it's going to take more than that."
Nick turned to me with a sympathetic expression.
"Even if I order the parts first thing in the morning, they won't arrive until Monday or Tuesday. We don't have that same-day service like in the big cities."
I bit my lip as I quickly and silently did the math in my head. Repairs to the oil system on my car, plus at least 3 nights in a motel, were going to add up fast. Nick seemed to know what I was thinking because he grinned at me.
"Luckily, my parents own a local motel, and they're always happy to give a discount to my customers."
I nodded. My only other choice was to ask if there was a couch at the garage I could crash on. Nick got my car hooked up to his tow truck, and we made the short drive back to his garage. Once he unhooked my car, I unloaded my 2 suitcases of clothes, leaving my few boxes of keepsakes in the trunk. I wouldn't need those in the motel. The drive to the motel was a cramped one. I had expected Nick to have a normal car, but we climbed into the tow truck again. Nick had managed to wedge one of my suitcases behind the seats, but the other was balanced half on my lap and half on the box between us. Every time we hit a bump, I worried the suitcase would knock into Nick's arm and send us careening off the road. We only drove about a mile before I started seeing a few houses and side streets. We passed a building with several shops in it, and then we rounded a curve, and I found myself looking at a sleepy little town. I couldn't see much in the dark, but the soft yellow streetlights stretched across a relatively flat space dotted with low buildings. A neon sign blinked on the left-hand side of the road. Green letters reading "Cowboys Corral Motor Lodge" were topped by a yellow cowboy hat.
"Here we are,"
Nick said proudly. The motel itself looked as mid-century kitsch as the neon sign. It was made of white cinder block, like the garage, and it had 2 wings that ran straight back from the street, with parking spaces in between them. At the front of the motel, centered between the driveways that led in and out of the parking area, there was a small, 2-story building with neon signs in the front windows that read "Office" and "Satellite TV." Nick pulled up right in front of the office. He had already climbed out and unloaded both of my suitcases by the time I had made it out of the passenger side. If I was going to be riding around town with him, I would really have to work on my exit skills. Nick opened the glass front door of the office, then ushered me into a room with a thick brown carpet and a front desk made of formica. The woman behind the counter had a grin that was identical to Nick's, and she spread her plump arms in a welcoming gesture.
Welcome to Nightmare, Arizona.
Chapter 2.
"Mama, Olivia here broke down on her way to San Diego," Nick said, nodding at me. "She's going to be here until at least Monday, so can you please give her the friends and family discount?"
"Olivia, is it? I'm Sue Dalton, but a lot of folks just call me Mama."
Mama reached out her hand, and I shook it without a second thought. Her hands, unlike her son's, were clean. She gave me an exaggerated wink.
"It's short for Motor Lodge Mama. Me and Benny have been running this place for almost 30 years now."
"Well, I sure appreciate the discount," I said. "I hadn't budgeted for a weekend in... Did you say this town is called Nightmare?"
"It sure is," Mama smiled proudly. "A lot of these old mining towns out west have funny names. Tombstone, Brilliant, that sort of thing. Life out here wasn't easy for those early settlers, so they had to have a sense of humor."
Nick gave me a firm clap on the shoulder.
"You're in good hands, so I'm heading home. Mama, I'll talk to you tomorrow. Olivia, I'll call you here at the motel as soon as I have anything to say about your car."
I glanced at my white blouse to make sure Nick hadn't left an oil stain on it before I thanked him.
"That's going to be $107.26, Mama said, as the bell on the office door tinkled.
In my previous life, that would have seemed cheap for one night, let alone three. Now it seemed steep. I pulled out my wallet and carefully counted out cash for her. I handed her 6 $20 bills, all slipped to me by friends when I had said goodbye and left Nashville. It had been touching and humiliating all at the same time. Mama counted out my change and handed me a key with a blue plastic keychain dangling from it.
"You'll be in room 13, she said. "It's a lucky number around here, and it seems like you could use a little luck. Just pull around. Sorry, I mean, just walk about halfway back, and it will be on the right-hand side on the ground floor."
I thanked Mama and followed her directions, the wheels on my two suitcases sounding loud as they rolled across the asphalt parking lot. I found my room easily enough, and soon I was sprawled on top of a brown bedspread that covered a double bed. The room was a little old and shabby, but it was clean. The floor lamp in the corner had a brown and orange floral pattern on the shade, and the carpet was a coordinating shade of orange. I was sure it had looked great in the 60s or 70s, when those colors were popular. The thin curtains on the front window couldn't completely block the glow of the neon sign, and its incessant blinking finally got me up and moving. It was time to do some accounting. There was a chance I'd have to stay there more than 3 nights, and there would be the car repairs to pay for. Plus, I needed money for food. That was an important one. In just a few minutes, I had a sad small pile of cash and some loose change spread out on the round table that sat in front of the window. I didn't have credit cards anymore, or even a bank account. So this was it. I was broke. I spared a moment to think mean, horrible things about my ex-husband, who was the reason I was in this situation right now. If he hadn't wasted all of our savings, then broke the news to me in the same conversation where he asked for a divorce, I wouldn't be stuck in a town called Nightmare. Talk about ironic. Briefly, I considered calling my brother to ask him for help. Maybe, I thought, he could wire me some money. But I quickly pushed that idea out of my head. He and my sister-in-law were already going above and beyond by letting me stay in their basement guest suite while I tried to start a new life, and asking for even more seemed selfish. Also, it just hurt my pride. "I can do this," I told myself. I didn't sound very convincing, so I pressed my palms flat on the table and said in a stronger voice, "I can do this." I had scraped by in my early 20s when I worked part-time as a server while finishing up college. If I could do it back then, why couldn't I do it now that I was in my early 40s? This time, at least, I had 20 extra years of life experience to help me figure it all out. I needed a job. That was all there was to it. There had to be some kind of temporary work available immediately, and I could stick around a little longer until I got that first paycheck. Then I would be out of this town and back on the way to my fresh start. The next morning, I wandered up to the front office to ask Mama where I might be able to find a job. I was happy to see a carafe of coffee sitting on a side table. I hadn't noticed it the night before, but after a restless 8 hours filled with nightmares about being stuck in Nightmare, I eagerly grabbed a styrofoam cup and started pouring.
"I see you have your priorities in order," I heard Mama call from behind the Formica counter.
I turned to see her smiling at me.
"Good morning.
And yes, I need a cup before I head out on a mission." I walked over and leaned my elbows on the counter. "I need to find a job, preferably something in marketing, like I used to do in Nashville, but I'll take whatever I can get." Mama's eyebrows shot up in surprise above her bright blue eyes, but just as quickly, her expression returned to a neutral one.
"Oh, you plan to stay a while? I thought you were on your way somewhere else and just so happened to break down here."
"Well," I said, averting my gaze,
I hastily took a sip of coffee, but it was too hot, and I sputtered as the liquid scalded my tongue. It didn't taste good. It was weak and slightly burnt, but I reminded myself it was free. When I glanced up again, there was something like sympathy in Mama's eyes, but her tone was all business.
There's a community job board you can check. It might be a little bare, though. Tourist season won't start until we get into the fall, when the weather finally cools down, so a lot of the seasonal jobs aren't available yet.
Tourist season? You mean people come here... I cut myself off before I could say, on purpose. Instead, I continued.
For sightseeing? Oh, yeah.
Mama straightened her shoulders and gave her fluffy, wavy gray hair a proud pat.
Nightmare was a copper mining town back in the late 1800s. When the mine went bust, this place practically became a ghost town. Then, artists started showing up, taking advantage of the cheap real estate for their homes and studios. After that, folks who like catering to tourists came along, offering mine tours, sprucing up the grand old hotel, and the like. We're a thriving tourist town now.
Mama gave me directions to the job board and promised it was only a 10-minute walk from the motel. Even in my khaki shorts and blue tank top, I figured I'd be a sweaty mess by the time I got there. It was shaping up to be another hot day. I turned left out of the motel and walked past a row of old wooden houses and a few small adobe buildings that housed businesses. Ahead, there was a higher concentration of buildings, which Mama had referred to as downtown. It hardly qualified as a town at all, in my opinion. There was a steady stream of cars coming down the road and turning a short way ahead of me, and I realized they were going to the same place I was. Mama had told me to turn right at the coyote statue, promising I wouldn't need to know the street name. She was right. The giant statue looked like it was made of plaster, and it was painted an eye-watering shade of yellow. Behind it, a squat building with no windows had a sign reading, "The Neon Coyote." It appeared to be a biker bar, and even though it wasn't even lunchtime yet, there were already a few bikes parked out front. I crossed the road and walked one block, then made a left as Mama had instructed. I was only one street back from the main road, but it felt like an entirely different world. No, I realized, not a different world, a different time. Here, the street had been covered in dirt, and the wooden buildings looked like something from a Wild West movie set. I stepped onto the covered boardwalk that lined the street, but before I could continue, I saw a blur of movement as someone jumped in front of me. A black and white flyer was suddenly inches from my face, and I yelped.
"Have you seen them?" said a voice.
I couldn't even see the man holding the flyer, let alone them. I reached up and grabbed the bottom of the flyer, pulling it gently downward. The man was dressed in jeans and a black T-shirt, which had a graphic of a cow being beamed up into a saucer-shaped UFO. His graying brown hair was slightly wild, and his hazel eyes bulged.
"They've been here before, but not for the last time."
The man's voice was shaking with excitement. "Who?" I asked. Part of me wanted to brush past this guy, but a part of me was also curious.
"The visitors."
"You mean the tourists?" The man laughed incredulously.
"No, the visitors from across the galaxy. Come join our watch party at Barker Ranch on Friday night."
He shoved the flyer toward me again, and I instinctively curled my fingers around it before it could fall to the ground. I nodded as politely as I could, then sidestepped him and kept walking. I guess every town has its weirdos. I passed a shop called the General Store, though it looked to me like it was mostly stocked with souvenirs. Across the street, an old wooden building with a high front facade and a balcony on the second story had a sign advertising a can-can dancing show. This part of Nightmare was something else. Even though the boardwalks were crowded with people who were obviously as modern as me, I still half expected to see a cowboy in a duster with a gun strapped to his hip. No sooner had I thought that
Then I spotted a cowboy in a black duster and matching hat walking right toward me. As he got closer, I saw him reach down and twitch one side of his duster away from his body. His fingers curled around the gun strapped to his hip.
"You got a lot of nerve coming to this town,"
the cowboy shouted. He was looking right at me, and I froze. Just as I was bringing a finger up to point at myself in a "who, me?" gesture, I heard another man's voice directly behind me.
"You don't own this town, McCrory."
I whirled around and found myself face to face with a guy who looked like he ought to be robbing a stagecoach. He was even wearing a red bandana over his nose and mouth. The first cowboy took another step in my direction, and I jumped out of the way.
"No, but you're not welcome here all the same, Tanner."
The one called Tanner produced his own gun, and I turned and pressed my back up against the wall of the general store as hard as I could. First aliens, and now a shootout? What kind of a town was Nightmare? Chapter 3. I glanced at a group of people standing right behind McCrory. Why weren't they running for cover? Because, I realized, they were too busy holding up cameras and cell phones. I felt myself relax as I realized this was a staged gunfight put on by actors. At the same time, I could feel my cheeks burning in embarrassment. How could I have not realized it was just a show for tourists? "It's because you've been under a lot of stress and going through big upheavals lately, Olivia," I told myself. "You've got hair trigger emotions." And speaking of triggers, the cowboys were still trading barbs as they began to move into the dusty street. I dodged the people hurrying past me along the boardwalk to catch the show. I had already made it onto the next block before I heard the distinct pop-pop of the cowboys' cap guns. The job board was just where Mama had told me it would be. The dirty old cork board was hung next to the door of the Nightmare Chamber of Commerce. A small pewter plaque below the board informed me the building had been the Nightmare Central Bank from 1882 to 1910, closing shortly after the copper mine had stopped giving up quality ore. I had been prepared for a dismal selection of jobs, but the reality was even worse than I had imagined. There were only 7 jobs posted. 2 of them were clearly weeks, if not months, old, judging by their dirty, slightly mangled looks. 3 of the other so-called jobs were for things that sounded vaguely like pyramid schemes. That left just 2 options for me. One of them started out promising, offering $400 a week in cash. I sucked in my breath, hopefully, then quickly let it all out in a sigh, as I continued to read that the position was for welding work. The final job listing was handwritten on a small piece of textured paper, not printed off a computer like all the rest. The script was slanted and the letters were sharply pointed, giving the words a vaguely urgent, excited feel. The first line read, "Nightmare Sanctuary Haunted House." I almost gave up and turned away right then and there, but I persevered. The ad went on to read, "Arizona's most popular year-round haunted attraction needs you. Get full-time pay for part-time work, paid weekly in cash. That is, if you're not too scared." There was a phone number following that, and nothing more. No details about the job itself, what it really paid, or even whether some kind of qualifications would be required for the position. If I needed some sort of skills, I would be out of luck. I had been to exactly 2 haunted houses back when I was a teenager, and I had kept my eyes shut and my hands clamped over my ears through both. Not exactly real-world experience. Still, I was enticed by the idea of full-time pay for part-time hours, and I was even more excited about the idea of being paid weekly. Maybe I would only need the job for a week or two, and then I could pay for the car and the motel and still have enough gas money to make it to San Diego. I didn't have a pen in my purse to write down the number. I'd stopped carrying one because I was used to simply using my cell phone to take a photo or type notes, and when I had given up my phone, I hadn't immediately reverted to my old-fashioned ways. My only other option was to take the ad with me.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?